Well, good afternoon, everybody. Dan DeGrace here with our fifth edition of Straight Talk with Rob Fisher, Italian Chief Rob Fisher from Snohomish, Washington. We got our special guest today, Chief Pat Kenny, which I'm going to introduce, and I'm going to let him introduce himself as well as Rob's going to introduce himself. And we got somebody you might recognize as well. Bobby Halton decided to join us today, so I'll let him say a few words. We do not have a two-hour show, so we're going to keep it short and brief. But I want to welcome you to Straight Talk. Again, for those of you that don't know me, my name is Dan DeGrace, retired out of Chicago back in November. Spent 30 years in the fire service, and the last 34 in behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse counseling. The topic today really is going to be open, and basically we're going to have a conversation. Rob and I are going to have a conversation with a good friend of mine, Pat Kenny, who I got to meet about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's kind of serendipitous how it happened. He knew me, but I didn't know him, and I ended up taking a seat right next to him in a meeting that was discussing mental health. I had done a interview for one of the TV stations on suicide, because those of you that know me know that, unfortunately, in my 30-year career, we had 60 of our active and retired members that died by suicide, unfortunately, two a year. So that brought me to try to bring awareness to that. And everything that leads up to somebody that chooses to die by suicide. Those of you that know Pat know that his son, Sean, passed away, and I'll let him, mention that. And there was a group of people that came together that wanted to bring awareness to mental health. I sat next to him, and he says, "Hey, I know you." And I go, "Well, and obviously I'm nobody, and Pat's Pat, and that's why he's our special guest on the show." But I said, I didn't know him. And he said, "Well, I saw you on TV." And then I realized that. Fast forward, getting to know Pat, 38 years in the fire service, husband, father, mentor, fire chief, advocate, survivor, super nice guy, pretty good baseball player, funny when he wants to be, great speaker. I've heard him speak six times, and six times, probably multiple times, I teared up. He has a powerful, powerful story. Something that we'll share maybe throughout this interview, and probably at the end. He's in the process of writing a book, which he'll talk about. That's really going to kind of uncover everything about him, which I'm sure is very vulnerable. In regards to what we're going to talk about, we're going to kind of find out a little bit about Pat and what he went through, and maybe he could give you some gems, whether or not you're a first-year firefighter or a 38-year fire chief out there. And maybe you'll be able to teach Bobby something too. Rob, my co-host.
Hey, it's good to be here. My name is Rob Fisher, and as Dan, you're getting good at saying Snohomish. I'm impressed. You're doing better. And but I work for a county fire department, 25 miles north of Seattle, and I'm a battalion chief and our peer support coordinator. I look at myself as more as Dan's color commentary when we're doing these things. I don't know how I got pulled into this gig, but it's been a great gig, and I get to meet really cool people. I have had the pleasure of hearing Pat talk a couple times. I think both times were Rosecrans symposiums, and powerful message. And as Dan said, it puts you to tears. It's incredible. I when working with our firefighters, I explained to them that, well, one of the analogies I use is that life is about picking up rocks, and you have a backpack, and if there's one person that's picked up probably a lot of rocks and maybe some boulders, it would be Pat, and how you balance that, how you balance your backpack, how you deal with all of that. You know, I'm just going to basically shut up and let Pat tell a story and kind of explain it. But it's incredible. And I look forward to listening to Pat more. So I'm just going to step out and probably just turn it over to Bobby to say a few words. And I see we got the senior citizen retirement community is opened up and they got a camera. So we got Bobby in front of that. But I look forward to today and thanks for having me on. And this is going to be a good talk.
Wow. Beat up Bobby Day. Okay. Everybody on this call is, we're all old and dear friends, just full disclosure. And I've known Pat a long time. There's an old saying, Rob kind of talked about, you know, picking up rocks or crosses or burdens, whatever you want to call it. And oftentimes people say that a man is defined by the circumstances that they encounter and how they handle them. But I think in Pat Kinney's case, it's somewhat different. I think Pat's character and personality, and I've known him a long time, have always been who you see, Pat. It's always been about first principles. It's always been about higher callings. I hate the pablum of this saying, but about just causes and the right thing to do. Pat's always been about just true integrity and honesty and forthrightness and irrespective of what he was going through. And he went through some tremendous things with his family, and I knew his late wife, and I was dear friends with her, and I loved her deeply. I always thought she married the wrong guy. Just teasing. Eileen would like that. She'd like that joke. She would love that joke. I've watched Pat, you know, with his pop and his son, and he's always Pat, and just an amazing man. And I think you're going to really enjoy his insight that he can share with us today. So, without any further ado, probably one of the neatest guys, and also the instructor of the year. Dan forgot. He's the 2020-2021 instructor of the year because 2020 got put on hold. And so he's the 2020-2021, the only instructor to ever hold a two-year instructor of the year title. So congratulations to Pat on that. And in April at FDIC, we'll be able to hand him his piece of plastic or whatever the heck we give you. And so well deserved, because what Pat has done is he's taken an incredible set of crosses or an incredible backpack of rocks and taken it out to the world and said, look, you know, life ain't fair, life ain't easy. And if it was, they'd have a better soundtrack, but you can endure incredible pain, and you do have support out there, and there are ways to get through things that you never thought you could get through, and he has, and he's written about it, and I can't wait to read the book. So Pat, I love you, can't wait to hear you.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks, Bobby. I would have said something like that, but I didn't know it was out for the public. And that's pretty cool that he's the only one that to be a two-year holder of that distinction. Bob, thanks for joining us as well, because honestly, we wouldn't have this forum, honestly, if it wasn't for you. You did take a little bit to realize how important this was, let's be honest. No, I didn't have to twist your arm. You actually had to twist my arm, because just like the keynote in 2018, you didn't ask me. You told me, hey, this needs to be talked about. The same thing with articles and the same thing with this forum to talk about.
Could I ask you one other thing, Dan? I know a lot of people want to ask Pat questions, and you and Rob. So if you do want to ask questions, I'll monitor the Twitter thing. But if you put hashtag FE Talk. I'll get your questions to Rob and to Danny and to Pat. So hashtag FE Talk. I'm sorry, Dan.
No, that's great. No, absolutely. We do, for everybody out there, Rob and I talk, and we have usually a list of questions to ask any of our guests. That's just to keep us on task because, you know, squirrel, right? That's what happens to us. But if you have any questions, just like Bobby said, hashtag FE Talk, and we'll try to get in there and talk to Pat. And hopefully, because we have Bobby on here, we won't be limited by time. With that said, Pat, the reason I wanted Pat on the show, honestly, was I'd say a good friend of Pat. I wouldn't say I'm really, really close to him, even though I've heard some really, really deep personal stuff. There's only so many people we let to be really, really close to us, let's be honest, to survive in life in general. You have a remarkable story, but I don't want to necessarily talk about the tragedy. I don't want to talk about necessarily the loss. When I look at you, I think of really resilience, and not what, you know, bouncing back, but don't take offense to this. I think of weathered, and you know, right? You have been through thick and thin, both as a person, as a parent, as a husband, and as a fire chief in two different departments. What I don't know if everybody knows about is a couple of things that we want to ask to add to the stuff in regards to the story you tell about the Cape. Really, my first question is a pretty easy one. What brought you into the fire service? And would you like to say anything to open up before I ask you that question?
Yeah, I would just like to say I'm done, because after those introductions, there's nowhere to go but down. So thank you. I am humbled, and as I always am, to be here. And I do echo what you said, Dan, appreciation to Bobby for the support. In terms of mental health, he's been a real advocate. He's gone through it firsthand himself and with his own family, and has been amazing in terms of standing behind us when we try to lead out into an area that's so full of stigma that there, you talk about, and Rob, you gave a great analogy about the backpack with the rocks. A lot of times those boulders are in front of us, and you need somebody to be able to push them out of the way or be a blocking guard, as I say, so the running back can get around the corner. And Bobby's done that, and I'm incredibly appreciative for that. So I'm Pat Kenny. I've been in the fire service for 38 years. How the hell did I get in here? I started off as a teacher, high school teacher, teaching theology. I quickly figured out that it would be less dangerous to run into a burning building than it was to try to get high school seniors to believe in theology. I was very unhappy in that role as a teacher, ironically, for what I've ended up doing for a lot of my life. But I loved coaching. I was the head freshman baseball coach. And so I thought I was going to spend a lifetime being a high school teacher. I'd been in a real bad accident when I was 14 years old, shattered both of my legs. I had all these aspirations of being a professional athlete. That kind of went out the window. So coaching was as close as I could kind of get to that. I had a brother-in-law who was a firefighter, and we had a discussion one day, and I told him, I'm kind of unhappy with the whole teaching thing, but I really do love to coach. And he said, have you ever thought about being a firefighter? Now, I grew up in the city of Chicago. I always laugh because sometimes when I do my son's talk, I did it in Boston once, and one young firefighter said to me, Chief, are you from Chicago? And I looked down. I didn't have any name tag or anything on. I go, I am. How did you know that? He goes, because you talk funny. So yeah, I've got the Chicago D's, Dums, and Does accent. Grew up on the South Side and by a firehouse. Now, when I was a young lad, I was an only child, so I was extremely spoiled. And in an Irish Catholic family, the way you're spoiled is you get fed. So I was not one who pushed myself away from the table. And when you're fat and your name is Pat, your early years are not a lot of fun. So the firehouse was an escape for me. And the firefighters who were there were always very kind, and I hung out and I really enjoyed it. So I thought about it maybe at that age, but also thought about being an astronaut and thought about being a catcher for the Cubs, which up until a few years ago, even in my mid-50s, I probably could have started for them. And then that kind of went away. And then the realities of life after the accident hit, and I went in and started to teach and didn't like it. And here's a brother-in-law resurrecting the fire service. And I went, you know what, I'm not even sure that I can pass the physical agility. I'm not sure. It's pretty rough. And don't you really have to know somebody to get on a fire department anyways? And I said, no, you just need to start testing. So with my wife's encouragement, I did. I landed on my face the first few times that I tested and was sure that there was the fix was in and you had to know somebody. And she kept pushing me. And I finally ended up in a huge consortium of about 300 firefighters. What seemed like everybody had a fire department t-shirt except the high school teacher, sitting in this gym. And I kind of looked around the gym and went, boy, I don't have a snowball's chance in hell. There's only three spots open on this department and there's 300 people here and I've got no experience. And the proctor, who I called an old man at that point, who probably was the age I am now, which is spry, by the way, said, you better be paying attention because if I pass you up, you're automatically eliminated. And he started calling out names and I was hypersensitive to when we got to the K's and went by Kenny to a Kowalski or somebody else. And I was like, whoa, I raised my hand. He said, what? He said, excuse me, sir, you didn't call my name. He said, what's your name? And I said, Kenny. He goes, yeah, I called Kenny. I go, no, sir, no offense, you didn't. Come up here. So now you got to walk embarrassed through all these people in the front of the room. And he's looking at my envelope and he goes, what's your name? I said, Patrick Joseph Kenny. And he said, goes, no, Michael. I said, no, sir. I said, Patrick Joseph Kenny. He said, okay, here you go, kid. I called it, but go sit down. Well, when I was 14, I lost my dad. He got sick the day after Christmas and he died that New Year's Day of a massive hemorrhage of his stomach cancer. Old school Irish, didn't go to the doctor, tried to self-medicate, actually using alcohol and ended up dying suddenly like that. My dad's name was Michael. So as I walked back to sit down to open that envelope, I looked around the rest of that room and I was no longer intimidated. Instead, I looked around the room and went, the rest of you guys are meat because my dad's going to take this test for me. And I ended up on the list and ended up getting hired. And there's no question in my mind, as you will hear me talk about, I have a tremendous faith and I believe in signs and I don't believe in coincidences. My dad took that test for me because I wasn't that smart. And that started me in the fire service. I started with that fire protection district for a year. The hours were really very, very long. We had our first child who had colic. And so I was working long hours, not home. Eileen was up and exhausted. And she said, you know, you have my total support to be a firefighter. You know that, but it's just not, can we go somewhere else? So I started testing again, ended up on another fire department and, through the ranks, went from firefighter to lieutenant to deputy chief to chief way too fast. But it just was timing. And then ended up doing this job now for 38 years. I have retired and unretired more than Brett Favre. Every time I think that I've got it, I take my uniform off and it pains me and I miss it. And as I said, something then happens that I don't anticipate happening. And all of a sudden I'm back wearing a uniform again. And it'll be hard when I take it off. It's been an incredible honor every time I put it on, whether it's for somebody who's passed or somebody who's getting hired or somebody who's getting promoted or just to greet the general public at an open house. It really does feel like wearing a cape, like you've been given something incredibly special because I believe the fire service is a vocation, not an occupation. And I got called to that vocation and pulled in and I'm incredibly blessed and thankful that that's happened. As you can see, I give short answers. Dan, got any more questions?
Well, we only got 20 more questions, so I'm sure we're going to be here for another. That's all right. So 38 years, you've been from the bottom to the top, retired back to the top or wherever. Mm-hmm. What's been the best job or the best rank over your career?
No question about this. It was when I was a lieutenant. I absolutely, and I think it was really around that whole team concept. I loved building a team. I loved getting a new unit of people and going, all right. And I felt challenged and I felt like a dad, regardless of age. And it was really an amazing feeling. And I always tell people when they, if they hit that rank, and we're all driven, we all type A personalities want to go to the top. I'll get a lieutenant who'll go, you know, I feel terrible, chief. I really don't want to move up. I love what I do. And I'm like, man, you passed the psychological. I said, that's good. You should feel great about that and be the best lieutenant you can be.
Yeah. I think when we look at it, you know, company officer is kind of like the backbone of the fire service. It's the one where you really, it's almost like uncle, you know, you kind of got to be dad, or, but you really do get to take care of your people and be a part of their life and everything. And so I'm not surprised you said that. I loved my days as a company officer. I don't know if Danny can remember those days, but go ahead, Dan. I think you might have a question.
Oh, man. You too, Rob? You can be replaced as well. And, you know, just saying. No, actually, that's something I didn't know about you, Pat. I could tell you for myself, the best job for me was being on a truck on the west side of Chicago. Everybody has their own thing. And again, I'm not saying it's better than anybody else. Just for me, having been, you know, a firefighter, lieutenant, a captain, a battalion chief, I actually liked battalion chief more than I thought I would. But that it takes about a good year, year and a half before you feel comfortable. I don't even know if I can say this on fire engineering, is that, you know, when you're in the buggy yourself and you smell a fart, it's not somebody else's. Can you say that on fire engineering? It takes about a year, year and a half really to feel comfortable being in a buggy by yourself, because you're with other people. You leave by yourself, you come back by yourself, you're on runs by yourself, but I enjoyed it. But being a firefighter, wow, man, that was probably the greater majority of the people that I know and just in my department would have stayed on the back step, would have stayed on a, you know, just in that rank. And I learned so much, and people think of trucks as ladders. Man, I think about extrication and trying to get into a building and EMS calls and, you know, car accidents and fires, of course, and all the other stuff that comes along with it. It was just really eclectic. It was like you go to work, and some of the people that I know that go to work, it's just, it's so mundane. It's like, okay, I got to crunch numbers today, or I got to sell toothpaste today. Man, you, as a firefighter and as a truck person, to be part of a team, I don't mind being led and taking direction. And the best thing about it is we got paid to break things, and you know, we got paid for it. So anyhow.
No, Dan, you said something that I think is really powerful and great advice for any firefighter, especially those that are ascending the ranks. And really, it's true in almost any walk of life, is that 12-month window to don't do anything drastic. Don't judge something until you give it at least a year, which can seem like an eternity if it's you're in a bad position. But it's really true, because you can look in the fire service, and when you're on the back step and look at the lieutenant, you can go, well, I would do this, this, and this. I know I would. If I sat in that seat, I would make sure I did this. Then all of a sudden you sit your butt in that seat. And I always say to new lieutenants, how'd you sleep that first night in the bunk room when you made lieutenant? And if any of them said they slept well, I said, then to take that freaking badge back and give it back, because you don't deserve it, because you don't realize the position you're in. And as you go up, it gets more and more stressful in terms of you have less fun and more responsibility, and you worry more about your folks. But for any position, it's like, just give it 12 months. And if you are totally unhappy after 12 months, there is no shame in going, this isn't for me. But don't make a knee-jerk reaction, because it might be something you regret.
Well, I'm just going to say, and there's many variables in this, and I didn't put out this study yet, but I'm going to do it down the road once I get some time. But we looked at longevity after retirement for people in Chicago over a 20-year period. And back in the 1990s, which wasn't very long, in 2000s, that it was 4 years of longevity after retirement. That's all. People would put a 30, 35 year career in, you have 4 years, and those 4 years probably weren't the best. From 2000 to 2010, 11 years. I don't know what it is these last 10 years, but the point that kind of I'm making and you're making, number one, as they say, when you move into a house, yeah, don't change anything for a year. It's the same thing you should do in regards to a job. Don't think you're any better or all of a sudden they came up with the idea that, hey, I'm going to fix things. Hey, get over yourself. There are a lot of great people over the years that have done things, and it's the person, right? The deliverer. It's also the delivery. But sit back and realize that
what leaders do. And we're real fortunate with fire engineering. A lot of people come to fire engineering looking for to be better and to do, you know, to get better at the profession. And so we have a lot of people that seek wanting to be a leader. And so I'm curious, you told a little bit about it, but, you know, what comes with that wanting to be a leader and how, you know, how can we do better at being a leader?
I think people need to probably consider before they jump in and go, I want to be the leader, about what's their motivation. One of the reasons, frankly, that I got back into the profession when I had retired as chief was I was really very unhappy with a lot of the chiefs that I saw out there in terms of what their motivation was. Not that they didn't have the ability to do the job, but the motivation came along with kind of the glory. You know, wash my car, I wear the gold, I kind of can tell you what to do. Nothing about when I walk away at the end of the day, did I make a difference? And is this place just a little bit better than when I got here? And are you better than when I got here? And did we have a mission that we all got behind and were able to make this place better? And so the people we protect end up in a better situation. So you got a question, why do you want to lead? Because I think some of us just follow that chain of that's the next mountain to climb. And as opposed to, do I really want to climb that mountain? And what am I going to do when I get there? And for me, it was important to make a difference. You know, we all sit in the oral interview and you hear 1,000 times, why'd you become a firefighter? Oh, I want to make a difference. I want to help people. Okay, that's great. What the hell does that really mean? And for me, making a difference meant was I wanted to have an impact on the organization. I always said it's fingerprints. When you leave, you should leave your fingerprints all over this place. Now, it might be that you wore a blue shirt your entire life, and it drives me crazy when somebody says, yeah, but I'm only a firefighter. That's a horrible statement. We're all firefighters. My rank today happens to be fire chief, but I'm a firefighter. And as a firefighter, you can put your fingerprints all over a station. It may be that you designed a pub ed program. It may be you were on a spec committee. You might be on the dive team. Whatever it is, you can impact your organization. In my mind, the leadership meant that getting a chance to be in a rank where I might have a little bit more say in where the organization was going was where I wanted to go. I absolutely had no aspirations of being a fire chief. That was not on my radar when I started in the organization. But as I moved through and saw that that could be an influential position, and I was mentored by a very successful fire chief with great people skills, and I watched what he does. I'd like to do what he does, and I think I can help this place get to another level. Drove me. So it drove me to do my training. It drove me to get my education. It drove me to try and see all the different styles of leadership. And as we all know, you can sometimes learn more from a poor leader than you can from a good leader. I've learned about here, Pat, are the things you don't want to do. And I have a long list of things and mistakes I've made in spite of knowing those things. But I wanted to make a difference. Now, along with that, given that ability, comes a hell of a responsibility. And I think the most difficult part for me, and the one thing in the 2 years I actually was retired and stayed retired, the only relief I had was I didn't go to bed at night worrying about, was I going to wake up in the morning and something had happened to one of my people, either through an injury or through a death or a severe impact in their own families. And that used to, and still does, become the hardest thing. So when you take on that mantle, you have to realize that A, you're always on. There is no off time. If you decide you want to get on the table at the wedding and wear the lampshade, you're going to be looked at as the leader who got on the table and wore the lampshade. Not that you can't enjoy life and not that you can't have a good time. And I'm certainly, for everybody who's on here knows, I'm not a stick in the mud and I can make a goof of myself just as good as anybody. But picking your spots and realizing that people look at you and they want to be you. And I think that was really hard for me to get used to. Like, why the hell would you want to be me? I mean, I'm this little Irish guy and got a bad temper and not very good looking. And why would you want to be me? And knowing that responsibility that they're watching you and they're trying to learn from you and that you really have that ability to impact their lives. My mom always told me, you know, the worst thing that ever happened, her biggest loss of money was paying for my college degree. I have a degree in psychology. And she said, you know, smart people run out of burning buildings and my Irish kid runs in. So that was a complete waste of money. And I always told her, she also wanted me to be a priest. I didn't do real well on the celibacy thing. So that was out. But what I told her was I use that all the time. And I said, I just became a minister in a different way. This is helping to lead other people. And you're leading not just them in what line do you pull, but you're leading them in how to be better moms and dads and how to be better brothers and sisters and how to be people. And with that is a lot of responsibility and a lot of sleepless nights. And if you're in it for the glory, get the hell out, because we don't need you. We don't want you. We want people who care and are there for the right reasons.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, being something bigger than yourself, being a part of something bigger than yourself and having an impact are probably the biggest things of the role of a leader. I mean, when we look at firefighter is a leader in everything. We lead the public, we lead other things. We lead up and down, you know, and it's not just leading. Leading isn't just pushing stuff down. Leading is pushing stuff up and being a part and taking care of our people. So I've been very fortunate to listen to a lot of stories from Bobby and from Danny and from you. And as and growing up and leading, getting to another level in my career, I always have just looked more at what impact am I making? You know, I know what impact Bobby has left in his career. And as an editor, it's different now. And same thing with Danny and where he's been. And I know you're doing the same. So, it's just something bigger than yourself, I think.
So I was just thinking that, one quick thing, Bob, and you could jump in because I did want to ask you a question, was that when you said getting on top of a table and wearing a lampshade, I just wondered if that bursted Rob's bubble in the sense of being a fire chief. So he can only get on top of the table, but he can't wear a lampshade?
The lampshade is more the designation of the five bugles. Some lampshades have five bugles on it, so it's just inappropriate. You kind of stand out more that way.
Keep that in mind at the next pool party. Sorry. Bob?
Well, as long as the lampshade came off the lamp of knowledge.
I knew you'd find a way. Attaboy.
Way to make it work.
Yeah.
I would real quickly, just while we're still on, not the lampshade, but just on Pat, you said one thing that you never had aspirations to be fire chief. And I'm curious with Bobby, if that was the case, because it seems like all of my friends or mentors that are fire chiefs, when I talk to them, they're like, I had no desire. I really never wanted that position. And here I am, I'm in that position. Curious.
My goal when I got hired, we were taught early on to keep a logbook, you know, for yourself. The guy who, one of my mentors that in my class, my recruit class that hired me, was a big fan of Marcus Aurelius. So he told us about meditations. I kind of had some interaction with that prior and really embraced the idea. And I still have it. My goal was to retire a lieutenant, was to make lieutenant. And back then in the organization I was in, lieutenant took about 12 years, 15 years. So it was, you know, and if things slowed down, it could be 20 years. So it wasn't as, you know, but fortunately it worked out completely differently. But yeah, you never, life's a funny thing, right? You don't know. And that's what I want to talk to Pat, because to really focus for a moment, because this is straight talk. And I think this is really important as leaders. As a leader of organizations, and Rob and Pat are actively leading in organizations. So we talk a lot about trauma and trauma from the job and accumulated trauma that from experiences, which is understandable and manageable. And we kind of wrap our heads around that kind of, I think we all can, right? It's something that we can quantify and qualify. Something that we can't is mental health. In other words, and Dan has studied it his entire life. And certain folks have chemical imbalances, and it might lead towards minor behavioral issues like attention deficit, or it may lead to depression, or it may lead to bipolar, or all kinds of things which are manageable, semi-manageable with today's incredible pharmaceuticals and therapies and things of that nature. And I don't think that many disorders, and I hate to use that word, or many mental conditions, I think is a better way to say it, don't preclude people from being firefighters. That they may just need to be assisted with, you know, being aware of when they may need to talk to their therapists, counselors, doctors about maybe a medication is not helping them as much as it used to, or maybe or whatever it is. So as someone, Pat and Robbie, as guys who are out there right now and gals who are out there right now, if you're in the audience, who are in those positions where you may have someone who, and I'm taking the accumulated stress and all of that out of the equation, and because Dan has taught me to, you know, draw a line there, right? And you may have someone who's an excellent firefighter, but they might deal with bouts of depression. They might deal with some obsession or some addiction that they have. And addictions are widespread across a variety of things. How do we, as bosses, leaders, people with fiduciary responsibility to the public and the other firefighters, how do you manage those cases justly, fairly, elegantly, as both of you are? You're both incredibly elegant people. And I think that's why we respect you as much as we do, both of you. I know I'm speaking for Dan at the moment. So, because you're both out there right now, and mental health is still stigmatized. People believe if someone shows, oh, I've got depression, take them off the line, you know, or I'm bipolar, get them off the job, or how can they be a medic, or this, that. None of that's true. They can be highly functioning people. They just need a little more understanding and a little more. I don't know how do we even say it, because we've gone so far in the last 10 years with peer support for folks who are impacted by the realities of the job, the objective realities of the job. We're still in our infancy with the folks we're hiring who are already coming from the factory, maybe a little bit different, not broken or not damaged, just different. How do you manage that?
I'll take a shot at that, Rob. I'll just tell a story. And I was thinking about it while you were talking, Chief. And it was, I did a talk in Michigan, and I got done, and one of the firefighters, actually he was the IT guy, came up and said, Chief, I got a story for you. He said, I really believe in when you talk about that a mental challenge, as I put it, he said, is a physical illness, because he said, I have a chemical imbalance. And he said, I was on shift with a medic who had diabetes. And he goes, long time ago, you couldn't be on the fire department if you were diabetic. Said, she's sitting there in the morning, part of our normal coffee, out pops the insulin, pulls her shirt up, boom, goes right on with her day. He said, I suffer from bipolar. So he said, I decided the next shift day I was going to try something. So as they all sat at the coffee table and she did her shot, he poured some of his pills out on the table. And his name was Mike. And everybody looked at him and said, well, what's the deal with the pills, Mike? He goes, I'm bipolar. And they were like, yeah, right. He goes, no, I'm bipolar. I need to take these medications to balance the chemicals in my system. And one of the guys looks right at him and goes, well, what the hell happens if you don't take those pills? He said, all around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I get an axe and I plant it in the middle of your skull. And he waited for the reaction of pure shock. And then he started laughing. He goes, no, I'm kidding. Of course, you'll always wonder whether I'm kidding or not. And his point was, this is the same thing. We're dealing with a physical illness. And I said, Mike, by that statement, you created a culture there, a cultural statement where you said, this is an illness. And just like we treat all these other illnesses, how many of you guys are here? Raise your hand if you're on high blood pressure medication. Raise your hand if you got high cholesterol and stuff that you didn't choose. Stuff that's not your fault, but is a chemical reaction in your body, does not prohibit you from having this career. Recognizing it, going to see a professional and getting treated for it, and then coming back 100% is the way you got to go. And I think in the fire service, I'm finding for me anyhow, as a leader in my own organization, delivering an analogy like we tell you when you come in, there's probably a good chance you're going to hurt your back. We go through all the levels of here's the proper way to lift and ergonomically we're great and you're going to do this just right. And we know we can't do that with the person who's in full arrest next to the toilet. Not going to happen. So you might hurt your back. So when you do, please, the first thing when you feel the initial pain is you need to tell somebody. Make sure you tell somebody right away. And then they'll send you to get evaluated. You might need physical therapy. You might not. You might need muscle relaxer. You might not. And then you'll return to duty and on you go. Why can't we make the same analogy that when we are in the fire service, whether it's on the job or off the job, you're going to run into traumatic events. And when you feel that pain, that emotional pain, that pain in your heart, whatever, you need to tell somebody, which leading into peer support. They may hear your story and go, yeah, you know what? That's above my pay grade. You're going to need a little bit of therapy. So you might or might not go to therapy. That therapist then may say, you may need a little medication because you can't do this on your own. Hear my message, folks. You can't do it on your own. And they'll give you the medication that you may take the rest of your life or you may take it for a short period of time. And if we normalize it, that it's an illness and an injury and it's something that you shouldn't be ashamed of, then it creates the culture I think you have got to have for people to come forward. And please don't mishear me. It's still not happening. I'm getting daily right next to me, seeing wonderful human beings who don't feel comfortable enough to ask for help. And the only option becomes taking their life. And we cannot stop being vigilant about sending the messages. This is not a character deficiency you have. This is an illness and it can be treated and you can come back strong. And we want you here. And we're just still doing, frankly, pardon my language, a shitty job with that.
Bobby, I'll just say real simply, because we keep on moving. I think what we fear is we just don't understand. So when somebody has a mental health condition or whatever it is, if we can't put ourselves in that position or we don't have the experience, and like the back injury is a great example. It's like we probably have all experienced it in our career. So we have an understanding. But not all of us have had to deal with mental health issues. And so we don't have the understanding, therefore we have a fear. And so then it becomes a stigma. And I think, you know, two simple words for me is one, understanding, two, compassion. As soon as I can have an understanding, and as long as I'm in this profession for the way that I'm supposed, I mean, the reason why I'm in this profession is I'm compassionate and I want to take care of people and I want to help everybody. That's not just the citizens that pay my salary. That's also the people that I work with. So if we have understanding, we have compassion, I think it helps us to address this and really what it leads to, the understanding and Pat said it, and I think it's perfect, is normalizing it. And we've talked about that before in mental health issues. I know Danny's talked about it, but we've got to normalize this so that everybody understands that it's okay not to have a good day. It's okay, you know, to have a rough time. We all go through it. And as soon as we can feel better about that, and we can, not better about the situation, but as soon as we can feel better about expressing that to our brothers and sisters that we're working with, then, you know, then I think we can normalize it and we'll be able to make some strides.
The other thing I would just throw in, and I think it's important as a leader, is you got to role model it. I mean, you can talk a good game, but if you don't role model it, then people aren't going to follow it. I'm going to see my counselor today. We had a tragic loss in our organization and everybody is depressed. And here's the memo. If you love somebody in your life and they're gone at some point, you're going to be depressed. And that's going to be a pretty damn normal reaction. But being able to share is, well, you're the fire chief. You're not supposed to say you go for counseling. Really? That's what keeps me going. So I think just sharing that and somebody at the kitchen table going, really? What's their name? Did you find them helpful? And all of a sudden it's like, give me the plumber who works for you and give me the electrician. Well, I want the counselor. And it just shows people that you too, A, I think as a leader are human, but B, that you truly believe in it. You're not just checking the box to say, I have an EAP program and I'm taking care of my folks.
If I could just share something here, it's really for anybody. It's not exclusive to any rank. It's to everybody. It doesn't matter if you're in a fire service, a first responder, or a mom or a dad, is that if you think that you're in a family, whatever family that be in, work or home, and somebody's not dealing with something, you are fooling yourself. The only thing that we did is kept quiet. That's what we were trained to do in the past and the present. And still some people live in the past and keep quiet. We've learned from NIOSH out of the five key things of why people die in the fire service. The number one thing, the key thing is poor or lack of communication. And if you go into your position in the fire service at any given time, and you have a conversation and you think everything is good, you're setting yourself up for failure. Somebody's kid is sick. Somebody's mom is dying. Somebody is going to get cancer. Somebody is going to hurt themselves that day. Somebody is dealing with a mental health struggle. Well, somebody didn't sleep well. Do I need to go on? There is something going on each and every day. One of the things that a good coach will do, will find the weak point in the defense to exploit that. What I say is, be a good coach, find the weak point and build that up. Don't exploit it, but build it up. If you're not somebody willing to look for the problem to fix it, you're exacerbating the problem, because that problem is going to blow up in your face at some point. There was one point when I was covering downtown Chicago, 55 people, 11 officers, 55 people, like I said. At one point, I had two firefighters whose spouses were going through double mastectomies. One whose daughter was brought to the hospital for suicide ideation. Somebody else that had a miscarriage. And I forget the fifth thing. That's just 50 people. We have 5,000 members. Whatever size your department is, something is going on. Fortunately, or maybe unfortunately, I've had 34 years in the field of psychology. One of the things that I didn't know about you, Pat, and people just found out here, you have a degree in psychology. People need that education. And that's probably what makes you a good leader. You had that formal education. You had that on the street cred, both as a kid, as a father, and in the fire service, which molds you into the person who you are. And that's why you're so easy to listen to. And that's what makes you a great leader. And that's, you know, why we love talking to you. What I would love to hear from you is, as you are now, what would you say to a young Pat Kenny?
I would say, first of all, that you need to, it's okay to make you first. I have behind me, you brought my email to see if I can get it over my shoulder, if you can see it well enough, but it says Mission Men and Me, and it was given to me by a friend of mine, and said, this is where, how I visualize leadership. And I said, you know, sometimes I think that thing's got to be inverted. It's got to be me first. Because what I find is I'm great at doing this preaching. So I probably would have been a good preacher. But I don't follow a lot of my own rules. I talk a lot about wearing the cape, and you got to know when to take the cape off. And I challenge people all the time about take the cape off. You can't fix everything. You're not God. And you need to take care of you. You need to get your sleep. You need to get the right nutrition. You need to have special people in your life that you can talk to. And I have some right on this call right now. And then I find myself driving myself into the ground until literally, usually what would happen is I would get very sick annually. And Eileen used to have a lot of compassion for me in the beginning. And after a while, it was like, well, you weren't smart enough again, right? So God took care of you and knocked you on your ass. And that was the quote. And it usually came up annually. And she was 100% right, as usual. And I have not done a very good job of that. I really am wondering, you know, when I went to a Catholic grammar school, and the nuns always talked about, you know, when you do things wrong, there's a big chalkboard and the good Lord just put a line through that. So that's one less day that you're going to be in heaven. I'm really kind of afraid of how many lines he's put through on that chalkboard in terms of days I've taken off my own life because I haven't taken care of myself. The second thing I would tell young Pat Kenny is make sure that you still keep your family in your sights at all times. Having buried a son and a wife, I can't tell you what I wouldn't give for one day with each one of them, for even an hour. I'd take loads of those marks on the chalkboard and tell you, yeah, I'll trade those days. It's okay. I just would like an hour with them just to talk to them and tell them how much I cared about them and how sorry I was. I sat in some board meeting with somebody debating over their neighbor's house was bigger than their house when I should have been home spending time if I had known I wasn't going to have that time at this point in my life. And Bobby and I have talked about this all the time. You want to make God laugh, you tell him your plan. Well, I've had him belly laughing a number of times. I didn't do a good job of that. I didn't. The other thing I would tell a young Pat Kenny is to be more vulnerable, that leadership doesn't mean that you're always a rock. If I had shared more in my own department with the struggles my son was going through, I think the culture there would have been enhanced. Instead, I hid it, I think for two reasons. One was, honestly, I didn't want him to walk in the firehouse and people go, yeah, there's that kid who's been in and out of hospitals with suicide attempts. But I had ulterior motives too when I really look in the mirror, and it was I didn't want somebody to look at me as the leader and go, geez, you can't even take care of your own kid. How are you going to take care of us? So I think those are the things I would do. Is I really think that self-help is the first thing. Is you know, we always tell a new driver, you know, if you drive that fast, we're not going to get there. And if we don't get there, we can't help these people. So you've got to be careful. I would give myself that same lesson. If you're not going to take care of yourself and you really think that you have some little value to people, you're not going to be around long enough to touch as many people as you want. I'm blessed that I have a new grandchild, 17 months old, the joy of my life. But I have looked into her eyes and thought, how long am I going to be here? So will I be here to watch you grow up, or did I push myself too hard? And those are the tough questions I ask, and I wish that I had known that when I was younger. So for, I guess, advice for younger firefighters on there is I would heed those. They're real easy to blow off. Trust me, I'm the best at it. But it really does mean something. And at the end of the day, when you walk out of that firehouse, you want to have a life left to spend with your family, because they don't really care what you did for a living. They really do care what you did for them. And you want to share that. So, and you may have no control over it, but if you don't try and keep it on the radar, you can certainly push it the other direction.
And you talked a little bit. Pat, you talked a little bit about it just in this question that Danny had for you, and we talked about it earlier in our talk today about self-care. And so I'm curious, what do you do self-care wise? What, you know, we all make mistakes trying to do that. You know, being an Irishman, I'm not Irish, I'm Italian, but you know, some people think self-care is whiskey. But what mistakes have you made, and you know, hopefully what good things have you done to take care of yourself to help you get through a lot?
Well, that's the stereotype with the Irish is not too far off. So for me, I found when I lost my son, that alcohol was a real easy thing to go to. And I would come home from work, and I was always a social drinker, so it wasn't anything unusual there. But all of a sudden I was coming home and was drinking on a regular basis. And that my son Sean had hung this heavy bag in the garage, and after a few drinks, and they weren't just a beer, I would start to beat the hell out of that bag and yell and scream out loud. I'm surprised the neighbors didn't have me committed, with a lot of obscenities about what a horrible dad I was and a loser, and you let him down and your only job was to protect him. You can't do that, you big shot, and all sorts. And that went on for probably a couple of weeks. And then Eileen challenged me and said, Pat, look what you're doing. We're going to have another disaster on our hands, and it's not going to bring Sean back. So The alcohol I realize when I'm under a lot of stress, or if all of a sudden a drink tastes good and I like want another one like right away, I walk away from it, or I don't have it at all because it's just too easy to cross that line for me. My dad was, I think, a functioning alcoholic. Alcoholism, unfortunately, runs in my family. So I have to watch that. I'm aware of that. That's on the downside. The other downside is when I'm under a lot of stress, I will eat anything and everything. Everything tastes wonderful. My wife used to laugh because she knew I had a bad board meeting by looking in the garbage can. If there was an empty big bag of Ruffles and then some onion dip container that was gone and a small container of chocolate Häagen-Dazs, I got my butt kicked at the board meeting. If the garbage can was empty, I probably hired 3 people and built a station and did everything. Those are the bad things. The good things I realize that I do, and I do it now, is I take time, go for a walk when I get up out of the office and whatever. I used to love to run. I hurt my back pretty bad when I was taking care of Eileen. So now I ride. And I'd be nothing to go out and jump on my bike and ride 14 or 18 or 20 miles. And I'm not one of these guys that's, you know, I'm not going to be in the any type of a race. But it's a good substitute, and I need to do something physical. And in the winter, I'll go up in the workout room and I will get on the treadmill, or I'll get on the bike or do something. And physically, even though I don't want to do it, boy, does it makes a huge difference. And the last thing I found that helps me is I really do a lot of stretching now. Never did any stretching. I was a catcher and never, not once stretched, which is why it's trouble tying my shoes. So now I really do a lot of that. And I try to do some meditation when I'm doing the stretching to pray and think about things to hopefully make myself better. So those are kind of the things I've done.
Pat, you know, a lot of people talk about how exercise is good for dealing with it. And I'm just curious personally, some like to detach. So there's like when you're working out, some people like to listen to music and they get into the music. Are you a type of person that likes to, when you're on your bike or when you're out for a walk, you like to detach and just let your mind process things? Or are you somebody that likes to listen to music and have, like, you're just out doing an exercise and you're just burning energy?
Depends on where I'm at mentally. If I'm kind of struggling, I like the quiet. I like to pray and ask for answers. And I find if I'm distracted, I may not hear the good Lord in my ear going, "Hey, knucklehead, you should be doing this." When I'm feeling up and good, then I want the music cranking and go to push it for a workout, get my heart rate up. And I feel good when I'm done. Like, okay, I'm 63, but for that 60 minutes, I felt like 62. So at least that's an advantage. And it helps.
So we're kind of wrapping up here. I know there's something that you want to share with us, Pat, in regards to something you've been working on. One thing that I want to kind of mention is that, you know, we've had some heart-to-hearts, but I really haven't said a ton in a sense of my thoughts. But it just actually came to me when you were just mentioning, number one, too, with the self-care. That's not something that is taught in the academy. It's not something that we take a class on. We hear it from people in a sense of you are what you eat. You know, we truly are. If we're full of emotion, we're a garbage can. You know, we stuff ourselves. And if we're feeling good, we don't have that upsetness in our stomach, so we don't have to feed it. We all know that. We really need education. Mm-hmm. We need more education. That's why the NFPA, that's why OSHA, and that's why NIOSH, it was created to provide us with data and to correct the things that we did wrong. In regards to all this behavioral health and mental wellness and longevity, we need education. We don't get enough of it. We look at it like for the other people because we're caretakers. But with that thing you just said in regards to the mission, me, and I thought that I forget the third thing because of my brain. But we do have to, like in a recovery program, have a selfless and a selfish program, because if we don't have me, we don't have we. As Bill Belichick says, do your job. And one of our jobs should be, what are we doing to take care of ourselves? Many of us say after a 30-year career that if we knew we were going to live this long, we'd take better care of ourselves, right? We joke about it, but that's the reality. Say, I wish I didn't have this ailment. But anybody can do anything at right now going forward for this marathon, not sprint. But when I think of you you know, when Bob asked me to speak at FDIC, I was trying to think of characteristics that embody what I think a leader, you know, somebody that I would want to follow. And those three characteristics are really the vulnerability, modeling, and mentoring. And you really, and I see why you got the, you know, the Instructor of the Year Award for 2 years, not just one, as Bobby said, is because you really embody that. You do all three of those naturally. You don't force yourself to do that. It just happens because that's who you are. You know, you generally are a good person. And I'll be honest, I think there's probably sometimes I know there's been times in your past you don't feel like a good person because of things that you have experienced. Get that. Tell us, we're going to end shortly. What are you writing?
So when I lost my son, Sean, to suicide in 2006. And then in 2016, I had this great plan that I was going to retire, my wife and I, and we were going to travel. And between 2009 and 16, I was doing talks about Sean, May Day for Mental Health. And I called it May Day because I think we didn't do a good job of calling May Day in the fire service until we really thought God was going to be on the other side of that door. And I linked it to mental health with being the same way. We don't reach out for help until we're at a really bad point. And in both cases, sometimes it's fatal. And in doing those talks and getting to 2016, I go, you know, I'm getting tired. I said, it would be nice. I'm going to retire and let's travel the world. Well, in January of 2016, she was diagnosed with glioblastoma and was given just less than a year to live. We had a son that was getting married that November, Patrick, and she pushed for, I'm going to make it to that wedding. We were 13 days out, and my son and my daughter-in-law, Abby, came and visited with Eileen and said, Mom, have you got 13 days left? And I was in the kitchen trying to hold it together as I listened to this incredibly emotional discussion. And at this point, she couldn't walk. She couldn't use her left arm. She was very ill. She said, I didn't fight this hard to miss this wedding. I'll be there. Very next day, November 1st, which in our faith is All Saints Day, I was home. I went for a run. I came back, and one of her best friends, Sean's godmother, as a matter of fact, was there. And when I walked in, she said, there's been a change. And I go, why didn't you call me? She goes, no, she's fine. You just need to talk to her. So I went into the room, and I go, hey, what's going on? And she said, I'm not going to make the wedding. What do you mean you're not going to make the wedding? We just talked about this last night. What happened? And she said, you can tell everybody I'm going to make my transformation. I go, okay, what's different here? She said, I saw Sean. I go, where did you see Sean? She said, at the foot of the bed. She said, Pat, he looked so healthy with this big smile on his face. And I just stood there and I go, you saw him right there? She said, yep. I said, did he talk to you? And she said, yes. So what did he say? He said, Mom, I'm coming to get you. And a few days later, before the wedding, week before exactly, she died. That last day before she went into the coma to pass away, there were a few things she asked me to do. One was, she goes, please don't retire. She goes, it'll kill you. It'll do bad things to you. She goes, second of all, she said, you need to live your life. You need to reach out. You'll find somebody else. I'm like, are you kidding me? I go, first of all, I'm not going to be lonely. I'm an only child. You were the one of 13. You'd be the one that would struggle. No, you're going to really struggle. So you need to reach out. You need to be open to that. I go, well, you're going to have to help me with that one. And the last one was, she goes, you need to write that book I've been telling you to write. And she had been on me since Sean passed her. You need to write his story. You need to take what you tell people and you need to write his story. People will learn from it. He will help save other people. He'll truly be that firefighter that we thought he was going to be. So I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And finally, I'm like, I just got to do it. So sat down and I literally started it the day that my daughter-in-law went into labor, the 17th of April. I started dictating it. And so this is what, if you can take a look at it now, it's called Taking the Cape Off, and it's leading through mental illness, unimaginable grief and loss. It's something that it's a book about hope. It sounds negative. It's about reality. It's about things that I went through and about how wearing the cape complicated dealing with those family issues, about taking care of my son and about taking care of my wife and getting caught in between that feeling of, why isn't that damn cape doing anything to help me save them? And how I had to fight through it. It's not just for people in the fire service. It's for any family member, any leader who's going to get caught in that. It is about battling that stigma of mental illness. How do you change that? It's supposed to come out in September. Now it's at an editor trying to translate the Irish guy's writings. If anybody's interested, you go to patrickjkenny.com and it'll take you to an email where you can put in your name and an email address and you'll get notified when it comes out. I look at it as a handbook that I hope people are going to be able to, whether they're dealing with mental health or they're dealing with the loss of a spouse or cancer or whatever, there are lessons learned at the end of many chapters that you might go, okay, what the hell did that guy say? And, oh, chapter 7, I just need to look at those lessons learned again. I really believe everybody goes through the pain they go through in life because you're supposed to take something away from that. And yeah, I've had some challenges in my life, but I also have had some wonderful things. A lot of people on this call right now are some of those examples that I've met through the pain. So there's a lot of positivity in this book, and hopefully there's a lot of guidance for people who feel like there's no hope if this happens to me. And back to what Rob said in the very beginning, you can carry that sack. It hurts. And sometimes it hurts worse than other times. And sometimes you just got to take it off and put it down and be okay with picking it back up and putting it on and taking another step. And not be so hard on yourself and look that you can do something positive in a day. And that may be enough to reignite you to come back one more day. So appreciate that. I hope if people are interested, they read it. I hope they get something out of it. I really do. I always had said it was my job was to make sense out of Sean's loss. And this is what his talk was about. And I think this is what the book is about, is what was the value of his life? What lessons did I learn from him, which were unbelievable amount. And the lessons I learned from watching my wife battle as a true hero against a horrible disease. So appreciate you letting me bring that up. I don't know how to market anything and have never written a book before. And I had no idea, Bobby, how the hell hard it is. Probably will never do it again. But if you're interested, that's how where you can go.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Pat. Since you plugged it, obviously, Bob's got to get 10%. Clarion's got to get 10%. I mean, yep. Just saying.
My agent will be in touch with your agent. I will get it. Once I figure it out.
Before I sign off on Straight Talk with my co-host, Rob Fisher, Bobby, thanks for joining us as well. Again, we said it in the beginning, Rob said it, Pat knows it. This forum wouldn't happen without you. I'm not going to kneel before you, just so you know. Anything you want to say?
Well, first of all, thank you, Pat. This is probably one of the most important hangouts we do routinely. It always, every week you guys exceed what you did the week before. And this will be a high bar. The mission, the men and me is the three M's of Vietnam, and Pete Blatter, who wrote the book by the same title, The Mission, Men and Me. One of my favorite books because my son Dean is actually mentioned in it. So, great book. It's about Operation Anaconda. Very important battle in the war on terror, so to speak, Afghanistan war. So anyway, that's where that comes from, in case anybody wanted to read the book. And I think that if you read the book, some people see it and they think it's, Pete is very clear. The mission always comes first, the men, and then yourself in the command process. But none of them are exclusive and none of them are indispensable. As Dan pointed out, every single one of them requires an incredible amount of attention. And I think Pat has laid out that if we're going to do for the community what we've sworn to do, we need to be aware of all of these things that are wickedly complex and incredibly difficult. And with help and support and understanding and empathy and kindness, we can get through all of this. It's all about love, and which is sadly lacking in society today. there's a lot of anger and animosity and finger pointing and motive ascribing, and very little understanding and love. And I think that the fire service, and Pat is one of the icons of that, that the more we love and the more we share and the more we empathize and the more we emote, the healthier we'll be. So thank you, Pat. And thank you, Dan and Rob, and for allowing me to participate today. And I love all three of you knuckleheads.
Rob, any last words?
Yeah, I'll just close out really quick. I'd just say that do yourself a favor. If Chief Kenny is in your area, or you can go to a conference when we get over COVID and we're back to conferencing and everything, get the opportunity to see him speak. Go and do it. I was looking forward to this conversation. I don't know Pat on a personal level like Danny does and Bobby does, but I was looking forward to hearing a little bit more and, you know, being more on the other side of the conversation. And like I said, do yourself a favor and take a listen. And I would say buy the book, because his story that you're going to listen to, I'll hear more than, I'd love to hear it more than once. And by having it in a book, I can refer to it when I want to and listen to it and read it and take it in as I go. And last thing I would say to touch with what Bobby is saying is we do need to, you know, we do need to seek understanding more, and that requires listening. And we need to spend more time, be it that it's easy for our firefighters, especially in newer firefighters, we tell them, hey, God gave you 2 ears and one mouth, use what you have the most of. And as we promote up or as we spend more time, we then end up having to, we're not listening as much. So I would say, listen a lot more, listen to your people, and that'll help them out. So that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Pat, thanks for taking the time out. Honestly, anytime I've ever asked you to be a part of this, and for those that don't know, he's probably sweating profusely underneath there. He's going to probably take some time after this to clear his head, right?
That's right.
He'll probably take a walk or run. He might take the picture of me and throw a couple darts at it. I get it. You know, it's happened before. I think Bobby's going to do the same damn thing. I don't know if Rob's there yet. he's got that face. Rob, man, smile. Pat, thanks. You are a mentor to many. You're a true leader, and you lead with your heart. So, Bob, thanks for letting us do this. Rob, I'll see you next time. And I know you have the date in your head. Oh yeah, snap, man.
I don't remember our next show. I don't remember our next show, unfortunately.
One thing, right? I gotta find a new co-host. Damn it! He's supposed to say nice things about me too. All right, guys. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, everybody. Love you guys. Take care.
See y'all.